here. But Eric is from one of those groups from the HBPA. Eric, good morning. How are you, man?
I'm doing great.
Tell
great
everyone what you do for a living while you move the mic a little closer to your mouth.
there we go.
All right, how about that?
All right.
He officiates football. That's what he does.
That's right. So, no, great to be here.
Yeah, good to see you guys.
It's always wonderful to be out here on the backside. You know, just as a horseman, this is where you feel at home.
Yeah.
But as the CEO for the National HBPA, I'm very honored. I'm going into my ninth year. Glad to be the representative for our affiliates. We are the largest of the legal horsemen's representative groups here in the United States. We have about 30,000 individual members. I've got 23 affiliates here in the States, and then we also stretch into Canada as well. So I am, as a trade association, by definition, I'm the mouthpiece, as it were, for my board. The HBPA, if many don't realize it, of all of the alphabet soups in horse racing,
Which acronym are you?
Yeah, we are the one that is elected, right? So our members, just like your members of state government and federal government, the members of the affiliate elect the board of directors. And that board of directors then sits on my full board. Every member has a seat. And so I end up being the person, the designee, that will partake in their representation throughout the country.
Which means that everyone agrees with you, and then, like, everything's
yeah.
like, you know.
Obviously, yeah. yeah. It's horse racing. Yeah, everyone gets along. That's
it's
great.
Easy
yeah.
to get 28 people to agree on the same thing.
28, good Lord, he is Eric Dabbleback. Yeah. At Eric the Tiger on Twitter, he's an LSU guy, so joins us here on ESPN 680, 105.7, ahead of Kentucky Derby 150. We are backside here. Otter Bowen Co. Horse Racing Happy Hour Takeover Edition. I'm reminded, one of the reasons I love doing these shows back here for 3 days, Eric, is just the reminder that once you get inside the walls of this place, there is a new city.
Yes.
This is almost a walled city. It's almost like we're in ancient Greece.
Absolutely.
Right? And there are just tons and tons of people whose livelihoods completely depend on this place.
Yeah. No, I mean, to me, it's the best gated community around. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, it's an economy. It provides not only entertainment for the outside world, it provides a living for those inside. And it is an economic-driven industry. We are entertainment-based. But at the end of the day, being on the backside, understanding what it's like to be back here, having the appreciation of what goes on every day, and I mean every day, that helps, and people understand it. And it's nice to share it on the big days like this. But it happens year-round.
Well, we got thousands of people though getting a paycheck,
literally.
From the teller on the front side to the hot walker on the back side, and you know, they might not all be getting a check from Churchill Downs directly, but it's amazing when people get back here. I think and really truly understand the economic reach of this sport and how many lives and all walks of life is how it impacts those people. So
absolutely, you know. The American Horse Council has always been good about doing economic impact studies in the racing sector alone. So taking the equine industry and carving out the racing sector, you're looking at a $62 billion impact in the United States. So that ain't nothing, right?
Right.
I mean, at the end of the day, it is a driver in the economy. And when you look at the agrarian base that all of the satellite industries that support it, whether you're talking about growing hay, you're talking about growing grain for feed. You know, you talk about steel building fences and all of the parts that go into the day-to-day work within the backside of a racetrack or a farm or a thoroughbred farm. I mean, it's an economic driver in the United States, and we want to keep it that way. It's an industry. Yes, it is a sport.
Yep.
It is an entertainment. But at the end of the day, it's an industry for so many, like you say. I mean, we being me as well, it's all I've done professionally since I left the racetrack is be in this industry. And that, I think, is sometimes not appreciated. Everybody sees it as a sport. They think of it maybe as polo or, you know, something a little bit different than an economic driver.
Eric Hamelback's with us. He is the CEO of the National HBPA. What does the HBPA stand for?
Horsemen's Benevolent and Protective Association.
So he is very protective, but not quite as benevolent as he should be. It's happening in Kentucky right now. It's happening.
Horse racing's
happening here, and you're a Lexington resident. You know, obviously Keeneland here, 45 minutes north of you, Turfway, the new renovation, the new track, Ellis Park, what's going to be happening there. the thing that is Kentucky Downs that we all love, right?
Yeah.
What is Kentucky doing that other states could do, and what could Kentucky get better at?
Well, at the end of the day, I think the biggest point that I would highlight is that when you look at the state representatives in the state of Kentucky, they appreciate horse racing. They appreciate, again, the industry side of it, the economic side of it, the tourism side of it. And so when you have a group of legislators that actually appreciate horse racing, it allows you to expand the industry without harming the industry. Mm. So you look at HHR, right, the historical horse racing machines that have, you know, been prolific in the state, and now we're seeing them expand other states such as Virginia, Arkansas. I mean, those factors that allow to expand horse racing without harming it, that's the key. And you do. You have a few states that are starting to mimic that. I mentioned Virginia. That's moving. Something that's very recent is Wyoming, right? Yeah, nobody really thinks about horse racing in Wyoming. But, again, very agronomist-based state, and horse racing is getting the benefit of some of the things that they're mimicking from the state of Kentucky. And I think, again, and there are plenty of states such as Louisiana and Arkansas that also have been able to marry themselves with good gaming providers that also appreciate horse racing, because at the end of the day, you know, we always try to emphasize there would be no gaming if you didn't have horse racing, right? You look at every state, and I always point to West Virginia because it was the one that, you know, really seemed to take off. They're allowed gaming facilities were based on the fact that they already had parimutuel wagering. You know, where I grew up in North Louisiana, you know, it started out at Louisiana Downs. That's where I started when I was 14 years old. And what happened? They brought in the river boats, right? Because at the time you could only do it on the river. But that, you know, expansion came because of horse racing. So it's important for us to make sure that we continue to push the fact that we were here first, and that there is going to be a tax at times where you're going to help us with our purses. And the racetracks such as Oaklawn.
National HBPA joining us here on ESPN 680, 105.7. It's a fascinating thing to watch, because you and I were talking about this off air. I see horse racing as not different than other sports, and I try to talk about it as much as I possibly can. And I know it's different. Every sport has its you know, idiosyncrasies and things.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I try to talk about horse racing as part of just the normal fabric of this show. And one of the things that I see happening in horse racing is similar to what's happening in college sports. Pac-12 doesn't exist anymore. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those teams have moved to places that are centered around Indianapolis and Dallas, right? Mm-hmm. Those kinds of towns, right. And those sorts of things. Horse racing seems to be doing something very similar, which is moving away from the coasts in its focus, or at least in its forward thinking. Now, they do get the new building at Belmont, so that's a real positive in my mind, at least, right? So there's at least state-level investment going on, right, on Long Island in New York City. That's a good thing. But we see the growth going in those places that you talked about. I mean, Louisiana, Arkansas. Indiana's becoming a great state. Right north of us, frankly, I think about 35% of the people listening right now live in Indiana. And so we're seeing this kind of movement to the middle of the country. I think eventually we'll see a movement back out of the middle of the country. That's neither here nor there. It could be 30 years from now. I don't know.
Right.
But we're seeing that happening. Am I making a decent comparison here?
I think you've made a great comparison, and I would be honest and say it wasn't something I had really thought of in that fashion. But when you team that,
gotta listen to the show more.
Exactly. when you team, you know, my thoughts, which I've always had this term, you know, degree of separation from agriculture and a lack of appreciation for horse racing based on the fact that kids don't, quote unquote, like me, grow up on a farm, right? And sure, we have less and less of that. So using your theory, I believe it makes a lot of sense, because where is the agrarian-based society still in the United States? And they are more towards the middle. I mean, Prairie Meadows is doing wonderful things. Nebraska is on the rise.
You were telling me about Nebraska.
Yeah,
gosh.
Nebraska is really on the rise. And, again, they've been able to team up with a good state legislative group, right, as well as a good gaming group, and they appreciate horse racing. So I think that makes a lot of sense. And again, if you go to Oaklawn, if you haven't been to Oaklawn, it's always been my favorite racetrack, and I say that because kind of growing up there, it's the only racetrack that I have a picture of in my office. It's that special to me. And when you see that many people support it because of the horse, not necessarily the gaming, because of the horse, that's the magic that gets people to the racetrack.
Yeah, I think that's actually fascinating, too, because now the gaming aspect is coming into the other sports, right? That's another way where they're coming to meet us and how they complement each other and whatever else. And we're growing from it. These purses that we're seeing here this week at Churchill Downs are fantastic.
Yeah, the purse structure here in Kentucky, I mean, right now I don't think you can say it's matched anywhere. But again, you know, you look at the KTDF program and the way that the Kentucky bred is able to go outside the state of Kentucky and still earn money, along with the AHHR inflection, I think that all of that has just been a, again, a long, I'm always going to appreciate the state representatives because they're the ones that really make it happen for us to be able to enjoy this and keep it within the industry of horse racing as opposed to some that just let gaming expand to the point where it actually is a detriment to horse racing.
I'm pretty sure we talked about this last year, but I think it's something that it's always worth revisiting. The call to have a legislative body over all of horse racing.
Mm-hmm.
Progress towards that, where do you think we stand, or and what are the biggest obstacles?
Should there be prospect?
Yeah, should there be progress towards it?
So, you know, I get the comparison a lot of there should be a commissioner like there is in the NFL or like there is
NBA
or whatever. The one thing that I try to highlight very quickly and get people to understand is, you know, players' unions, you know, they have contractual obligations that they can go through with their ownership groups. It's not like that in horse racing, right? Maybe there's a lot of us that would love to have a little bit more of a collective bargaining sort of power. But at the end of the day, the reason that a commissioner, and again, this is my opinion, I'm not voicing a national HBPA opinion here. My opinion is no one really understands the fact that horse racing is based on law, right? Most people see rules. Most people see Eric throwing a flag on a holding penalty. That is a rule. Yes, we have rules and regulations, and they use that term, but at the end of the day, it's in state statute, or now under HISA regime, it's in federal statute. That's a law. So to have a commissioner who can oversee the entire horse racing entity, I think is a bit unattainable. You know, you have 32 owners in the NFL. You have 32 owners maybe in one race at times, especially with the partnership groups now. So I don't think it's attainable. I'm not necessarily saying that there isn't a structure that can help coordinate things. I mean, I think when you look at the history of horse racing, why was the NTRA developed? The NTRA was developed originally, and I'm going way back, it was developed to bring about people and educate them on horse racing, period, right? You know, I always had this dream of having, you know, Jerry Bailey jump off a horse and slam a Gatorade, you know, something to get the connection. That's what the NTRA was originally devised to do. It hasn't really evolved into that, but again, racetracks have tended to become more of their own marketers,
right,
not the industry. You know, I always look at the PGA, what pre-Tiger, they got together and they said, we're going to develop a fund. It's going to come from purse structure, and we're going to advertise golf. We're not going to advertise Augusta or Torrey Pines or any venue. We're going to advertise golf. That's the missing link that has happened in the horse racing industry.
Great point.
When the NTRA didn't become that broadcasting body of educating the United States on horse racing. So can we get to that point? I hope so. Is it going to be under a single commission or commissioner? I don't think so at all.
Eric Hamelback with us from the National HBPA. The interesting thing that you just mentioned there is something I think Mike and I have tried to do on our podcast is we just go to the spots where the big races are happening. We
right.
try to talk to people where they are on the ground and get the idiosyncrasies of their tracks and get the idiosyncrasies of their owners. And, you know,
right.
Doug O'Neill has a bit of the, you know, the feel of a Kenny McPeak west of the Rockies, you know, this kind of stuff, whatever, right? Just
exactly.
getting these feelings around the country. And one of the great things about horse racing is the regionality of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that, you know, that's the thing. And the one thing that you guys have been great about, too, you know, most I don't want to say they're all like Bill Belichick, but most horse trainers are, you know, they're private folks, they're hardworking, and they're not really
they're scheduled people.
Yeah,
that's right. Yes.
And so that's why we need an organization to really promote horse racing. But at the end of the day, the regionality, I mean, yes, it creates some of the separation, but it also creates the competition, right?
Sure.
It's, you know, it's like the SEC and Big Ten. You know, you got people from different parts of the country, and when they come together for competition, that makes it fun, that makes it exciting. That's obviously what makes the Derby so cool. Plus, now we got international competition.
Yeah, I was going – boy, you predicted my next question. Zach, let's take a break, though. We'll come back with Eric. 10:40, we'll talk to Ron Moquette. He's down at Oaklawn Park.
He is.
Speaking of.
Favorite track.
Yeah.
Hanging out with Matt
Dinner. We're going to just – look.
We got to mention Matt Dinnerman.
Matt's welcome. Comes on the happy hour five times. Gets a job at Oakland.
Elevate people.
It is what it is. These are things. Eric comes on here. He gets to keep the job.
He's probably going to be the president of the United States.
It is what it is. All right. But we are presented by the Kentucky HBPA, KYHBPA.com. Go check them out. Jenny's sitting right next to me, which is the first time she sat down since about 4:30 this morning. Videos.
Which stall are you living in?
This is her apartment right here. Yeah, she keeps those cactuses right there.
Yeah.
All right. We are presented by them. Go check them out. Tons of great articles, videos, pictures from around the track for sure. As we get ready for Kentucky Derby 150. Louis Rabot alongside Mike Gandolfo. Horse Racing Happy Hour takeover of Rabot Co. More with Eric Hamelback next here. ESPN 680 105.7.
As an LSU fan, knowing how much the University of Florida embraces Tom Petty, can you enjoy Tom Petty?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
All right.
Okay. Wow. Yeah.
We can be Florida's fine. Not a threat to LSU.
No.
Not anymore.
Spurrier ain't walking through that door. That's right.
Exactly.
Talk about Kentucky.
Urban Meyer's not coming through that door.
Also that, right? Yeah. Oh, man. But Eric Hamelback is with us. He is the CEO of the National HBPA. The word benevolent is in there somewhere. We were talking about a lot of different things, but we look, some of the advocacy that you're working on right now deals with a federal legislation known as HISA, HISA.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that almost certainly the people that put it together thought they were well-intentioned and were going to do good things. But we've talked about the regionalities and the differences around the country, Eric, as far as medication testing and different things. I always laugh this day because I'll look and a horse was on Lasix, for example, in Louisiana in a graded stakes, but they weren't in Kentucky or something and these kinds of things.
Yeah.
Talk about what you're working on right now. I don't want to lead you down a path here.
No, that's fine, Louis. Thank you. I want to obviously open up and say that, you know, with the intention of passing HISA, the Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Act, I would not sit here and say that our goals as an organization were different. That being said, uniformity within testing, uniformity within wanted that uniform from state to state. We all want safety regulations to be increased, but safety regulations definitely take into effect the regionality. You can't treat a racetrack at Santa Anita the exact same way you treat a racetrack at Churchill. So we don't want, you know, a pigeonholed, everything has to fit in this square mentality for that. But under the HISA regime, we were very open in our analysis of the bill well before it was passed. We advocated against the bill. We, alongside advocating with other horsemen's groups for many years, understood that and felt that and certainly still believe that HISA is unconstitutional on its face. Okay, so set that aside. We also are law-abiding citizens. Horsemen have never been regulators. You know, you hear all of that to me, very frustrating rhetoric that, oh, well, horsemen had, you know, decades to quote-unquote get it right, and you are the reason HISA is there now. No, people, horsemen have always been regulated. We have never been regulators. And so we were not the ones putting everything together. As a matter of fact, a lot of the leadership still remains the same, and there's problems with that. So, but we understand it's the law of the land. It is a federal law. And while we are litigating HISA, and currently there are four cases that are active engaging the constitutionality, also including the one, Louis, that you bring up,
yep.
West Virginia and right. the state of Louisiana, that is case three. That is what has them enjoined from HISA altogether. So those two states, along with Texas, along with Nebraska, don't operate under HISA for various reasons. But the states who are participating, we understand it's the law. But we're also trying to, alongside of the fact we are litigating, we are still trying to do what we can to work to make things better. Because the courts are going to decide what they're going to decide. And I respect Mrs. Lazarus from the standpoint of she has a job to do.
Who is Ms. Lazarus?
So, I'm sorry. Lisa Lazarus is the CEO for the Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Act. She has a job to do. She's outside the litigation. Right now, her goal is to get the uniformity horse racing is all looking for and find a way to make it work. So now, during the litigation, yes, our organization does try to have some positive impact on what can be changed. You know, we openly say that the construct of the bill did not have all the right people at the table. And I don't think you can deny that now when you look at some of the things that have tripped HISA up and HIWU, the Horse Racing Integrity and Welfare Unit, the testing enforcement aspect. Now you're seeing some of the problems that we, quite frankly, in D.C. waved the flag saying this is a problem.
Right.
And I often now start my conversations in D.C. with, you know, I carry around my I told you so flag. Because not to be obstinate, certainly not to be an obstructionist like I get labeled on Twitter all the time. We were there and wanted to try to make it right, to make it better. And I've said actually to Ms. Lazarus, if they would have just adopted a model rules of one state, I always laugh and say pick a state, Kentucky, California, New York, adopted that set of model rules and moved forward, there would have been much more buy-in because the adjudication would have been the same.
Yeah.
And ultimately,
everyone would have understood the rules at the outset as well, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
And the enforcement, which has become very much a problem. And, you know, so for our mission right now, our biggest advocacy really revolves around what I term no-effect thresholds. And that's not new. You know, I don't want any of your or listeners to think that, you know, we just pulled this out of the hat. We have always really tried to advocate for no-effect thresholds. So what does that mean?
Yeah.
When you're testing for racehorses now, the testing sensitivity, and I would say in the last decade, has become so sensitive that we are picking up things that are in the environment. If you look at the EPA, so the Environmental Protection Agency, when they test drinking water, they don't test below or anything, I would say, in the picogram level.
For humans. Right.
That makes it a legal drinking water.
Yeah.
So, but what's happening in our industry is that we have a presence of sort of mentality. If it's in the horse, no matter what the quantity, you're going to have a violation.
Can you give an example here? So Eric Hamelback with us, CEO of the National HBPA. So give an example of this environmental versus something that would have been administered by a physician or whatever, something like, you know, some kind of veterinarian. What's an example? You know what? Let's do it. Let's make it personal. Pick mm-hmm. someone who has probably had an environmental issue mm-hmm. and what that was, mm-hmm. who it was, and then what the penalty was, frankly.
Well, I'd like to pick Rusty Arnold because he's been very vocal.
He has been, yes.
I feel very comfortable talking about his situation because I'm passionately supporting.
And by the way, been on this show, terrific guy, clearly
person,
cares. Yes,
clearly,
good guy, cares about the horses.
Exactly.
Yes.
So he had a horse who tested positive for a human medication called tramadol. Tramadol is essentially an anti-inflammatory. The
anti-inflammatories, it should be said, is a big part of horse racing.
Absolutely.
Recovery for horses.
Absolutely.
They're like every other athlete on the planet that not having inflammation is a good thing. Right?
Absolutely. Right. So a legal anti-inflammatory just decides
that's like taking Tylenol.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So Tylenol or Advil in the horse world is called Bute.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
Banamine is another one. Ketafen is another one. Now, you can't use them all together. We call that stacking. But as a professional athlete, yes, anti-inflammatories
yep.
are positive. But this is not – tramadol is not a medication normally. I'm not going to say never, but normally is not an equine-specific
right.
anti-inflammatory. Therefore, when a horse gets exposed to it in some fashion, whether it could be, you know, rubbing lips on a stall wall or a webbing, or in often cases what's happened is you might have a groom who urinates in the stall, infects the straw of the bedding, and the muzzle of the horse connects with that, and you'll have a trace level of what we call transfer contaminant, which ultimately then will cause a positive. But what we're trying to institute, what we're trying to bring to light is, from a scientific view, at what effect would that medication have something to perform or to enhance performance in a horse, right? And so that's why we say no effect thresholds.
Right.
We believe that in most circumstances, even looking at methamphetamine, cocaine, you know, there there are contaminant levels that you will find in the environment. Many legal medications like metformin, you know, we tested two different water sources at a racetrack in Indiana, and we found metformin in the drinking water at micro levels. So, again, it's in the environment. And, you know, 10, 15 years ago, when the laboratory equipment wasn't as sensitive, it wasn't a problem. Now we see it as a problem. We're trying to get to the point. But what's the point, right? Why are we fighting so hard to express no effect threshold? Because the public sees every positive as a negative, right? If you get a positive test, our racing public suffers for it. And what ends up happening under the current regime, and I'm going to use this term, the term now is you're guilty until proven innocent. It's an entirely different adjudication process than historical and, I would say, constitutional. So, you know, you're done, you know, based off some circumstances until we get it, quote unquote, adjudicated. But there's a threshold amount, a no effect threshold amount that we're trying to get to. But we also feel that it's because we don't want there to be any more black eyes on horse racing when it isn't really causing a problem.
I got two things for this. Eric Hamill back with us from the National HBPA. Do you remember Sha'Carri Richardson, the sprinter who couldn't go to the Olympics because of marijuana?
From
LSU, right?
Yeah.
And I remember at the time, I was doing shows with Dan, and I said, I think she should get to go. Like, this isn't performance enhancing.
Right.
I mean, like, if she's stressed out and she, you know, pops a gummy or something, that's going to help her sprint? I mean, give me
a break. She's not in the rifle.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah. No, that's exactly right. Yeah, she's not doing biathlon here. You know, those sorts of things. The other one was something that I completely forgot now. Doggone it.
I'm sorry for talking.
No, it's okay. The Sha'Carri Richardson one reminds me of that, though. But, like, this idea of what is performance enhancing, what isn't, right?
Right. I mean, you know, and there are certainly levels of the same medication that could be considered performance enhancing. But if you look at, you know, one of the medications that we're really dealing with now is metformin. Metformin is an anti-diabetic drug, or I guess diabetic drug, I guess how you say that. But it is, I believe I'm quoting this correctly, the third most prescribed medication in the United States, right? So it's everywhere.
It's going great here, us fat people. Yeah.
And, you know,
I'm pointing at Mike and ignoring.
When you compare.
Mostly Mike.
Compare often, as I do, what does it on the WADA list? So the World Anti-Doping Association list. Metformin is not a performance-enhancing medication with WADA. Yet the metformin positives have been very prolific, you know, unfortunately, but in horse racing, and we're trying to deal with it and make and create an understanding for the folks at HIWU that, you know, we need to push for a no-effect threshold because we – and in particular, the public don't need to be alerted to something that doesn't have a performance enhancement in the horse.
The stunning thing about this is in the United States generally, you know, if you're on trial, they'll release you on probation, essentially, right? And, you know, you got to show up for the trial and you got to do those things.
Yeah.
This is, I mean, a guy like Rusty Arnold, this is essentially detainment.
Yeah.
I mean, it's career detainment. It really is. And that's a really... I think people lose sight of this. So I've had Jonathan Wong on the podcast a couple times.
Yeah, great guy.
Right. Bay Area guy, really tried to slug it out at Golden Gate Fields. I mean, like, one of these guys that literally is trying to prop up. He had a horse in every race out there for a while. I mean, like, and even he had to move to Kentucky, and then there's an environmental issue, and he's done. Two years. Just tell you, hey, you're going to jail, brother. I mean, and they just did it. I mean, it's literally messing with people's livelihoods. I mean, we're talking families. And when we talked about to open this interview, you get inside the walls of this place, and there's a freaking town. You shut down part of that town.
Exactly. You know, and, you know, and the fact that it's, you know, in the environment, obviously it's a societal problem when you're looking at, you know, recreational drug use. Sure. But we're not isolated. Right. Obviously, you know, it's in every industry. And we do a good job, I think, from an educational standpoint. And obviously trainers are doing better at getting to the point where they're educating, you know, staff and help better. But you're not going to get rid of it. You know, Jonathan, his case is, you know, almost a mirror image of Mike Lauer, again, a trainer from Indiana, who races tremendously here in Kentucky. And yet the you know, you look at how the cases were adjudicated and ultimately, you know, the suspensions handed down, certainly not uniform, but yet they both had grooms who had prescriptions for it. They both had prescriptions for it themselves. So there are some things that still need to get worked out. But, again, I'm going to continue to preach and really focus on no effect thresholds, because we have the science even behind drugs that we don't want to hear about, like methamphetamine, certainly metformin, certainly tramadol. We have no effect thresholds, and we're working to try to make that at least something HIWU will reach for and have the understanding that the science is there. This is not something we're just pulling out of our hat.
Well, congratulations on your pharmacy degree. That's a fantastic accomplishment by you. But he is Eric Hamelback, at Eric the Tiger on Twitter. You can go call him an obstructionist there. He is with the National HBPA here on Remote Co. on ESPN 680, 105.7. We got to go, but I do encourage people, KYHBPA.com this week, go check them out for sure. Eric, here's what I want to do with you.
Okay.
Can we do a series of chats with you on the podcast about what you're working on? And I don't want to say bring on like someone to debate with you or whatever, but bring on someone from a part of the industry that we want to talk about. Can we do like a 4 or 5 part series with you?
Yeah, no, I'm definitely looking forward to
put him on the spot, man.
No.
If I do this in front of thousands of people,
he's gotta say yes,
or the 30 listening to this show, then he has to do it. That's right.
That's right.
Right. No, I am definitely up for that. I mean, great. You know, we have some constraints that revolve around the litigation, but at the end of the day, healthy debate is where we need to be.
I do remember, and I'll close with this because I think it's an important anecdote. 2 years ago, I interviewed Umberto Rispoli because he was going to try to move his tack here. Right? He just had a baby, the whole thing. And I interviewed him, and I did the, hey, do you feel like you get a fair shake every time you go to the gate question?